My name's Bob Darrell, and I'm an alcoholic. Join me in a moment of silence while I open with a prayer. Father, help me to set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about others, and everything I think I know about my own recovery, all for a new experience in you, Lord, a new experience in myself, a new experience in my fellows, and a much needed new experience in my own recovery. Amen. A couple little announcements before we start rocking and rolling. Al, our illustrious recorder, sound engineer. I like that. That's good. Sound engineer. You know, he's decided. Usually, they sell the CDs for about $7 or $8. He's gonna, if you buy the whole set, it comes out to about a little over $4. He's gonna sell a set that looks like it's gonna be 14 CDs for the weekend. And he's going to sell them for $60, which I think comes out to about $4.20 a piece, which is a pretty good deal. Also, over on that table, there's a basket, and it's for questions. And I don't know that you're going to get answers. You may get dumb looks, but we're going to try to see if there's anything from your questions that brings out something from our experience. We're going to do that tonight, so please feel free to put anything in there you want. There's paper and pens over there. Also, on the itinerary, it says that we're starting at 2 o'clock after lunch. We're going to actually start at 1:30. And the reason is we're having lunch brought in here, so it shouldn't be there. We don't need an hour and a half to 2 hours for lunch. An hour or more, a little around an hour is fine with the food already delivered here. So we're going to – and that gives us a little bit more time to cover the material and share the experience that we're going to try to share today. And also, Alcoholics Anonymous is fueled by anonymous labors of love. But in that light anyway, I would like to recognize the committee that did this. Would anyone that was involved in putting this on, would you stand up, please? Just okay. And if you'll notice something, if you're fairly new in AA, you'll notice something I've noticed over the years. The people that are real involved in service in AA don't seem to be as depressed as mopes like me that don't do nothing, you know. So it kind of encouraged me to get involved in some of that stuff. Yesterday, we covered we covered step one pretty well. We saw that we are literally in a trap we can't spring. There's a yearning and a thirst for the effect, and once we try to obtain it, there's an allergy that this every drink I take makes lights up something that demands more, and consequently, I burn my life to the ground again. Swear to myself, I'll never do that again. And in abstinence, it just this all the feelings of untreated alcoholism start to gnaw on me, and eventually, I return to it. I have no mental defense against that. Page 25, it talks about something that is a precursor to step two. It talks about something that, in my experience, I had to believe in before I ever could go on with the rest of the steps, before I really could be sponsorable, before I could pray, before I could do any of that stuff. And it says, there is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which this process, and recovery is a process, which it requires for its successful consummation. And that's true. I've never met an alcoholic yet that came to AA in the middle of the despair and hopelessness of alcoholism. You just burnt your life to the ground again and looked at the steps and went, oh, great, that'll work. Nobody says that. No, it's you don't even get that it works till you're after you do it. We don't believe AA. No alcoholic believes AA will work until after they do it. And then it's like everybody says the same thing. Oh my God, I should have done that years ago. And here's what here's the first realization, the first awakening. We saw that it really worked in others. I had a run-in partner in a treatment center. Boy, he was just like me. And we both just hated AA, and we had to go. We didn't like it. And we both knew that we couldn't drink and we couldn't do any hard drugs, but we can't. But we're both in the same boat here. We can't imagine life without something, for God's sake. So we thought, well, marijuana is organic, for God's sakes. I mean, you know. How bad could that be? I never punched a cop stoned on pot. I mean, you know, pot's cool. It's mellow. It's mellow. It's almost spiritual. So we started smoking pot, and I noticed the joints got bigger every day. I mean, just and we'd go to meetings stoned. And I got to tell you, some of you guys sound a lot better when I'm stoned. But I drink again. I mean, are you surprised? No. I mean, of course I'm not treating my alcoholism, and I'm keeping the door open to treat it with something else, right? So it was just a matter of time before the pot wasn't enough. It was an inevitability. And I get thrown out of this place, and I start drinking that cheap wine again. And in no time at all, I'm in bad shape. I mean, bad shape. I'm shaking. I'm living in this abandoned building, and I'm not eating. Now, I'm not against eating. I just can only hustle so much money every day, and I ain't going to eat up my drinking money. You know what I'm saying? It ain't going to happen. So I'm not eating, and I got some sores that won't heal because I got that vitamin deficiency going on. I got hair down to here, and because I'm laying on the ground in this half-burnout project building up on the hill in Pittsburgh, I got dirt and I'm dirty. I don't bathe, and I got the same clothes on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I've wet my pants and I walk around in it, and it's pathetic. And what I do in order to get drinking money is I go back to the recovery place I'd been thrown out of when I drank again. And I go back there and I stand off a property because I can't go on the property. And I wait for guys coming out that are on their way to do laundry or to work, and I bum nickels and dimes from them. Because some of them I knew. I was too afraid. I would do it sometimes, but I had this fear of actually asking people for change. I was afraid of that rejection. I remember I was 10 years sober before the first time I was driving down the street and I ever saw a guy that had a sign that said, "We'll work for food." I almost wrecked my car. I thought, oh, that's brilliant. You don't have to ask nothing to nobody. You just stand there. I almost wanted to go back out again. I thought, oh, man, look at that. That's brilliant. That's awesome. So I hang out there, and I'm bumming nickels and dimes for guys. And one day my running partner comes out, the guy that I hung with. And him and I were like this, and he saw me, and he looked at me, and he gave me several dollars, and several dollars was a lot of money to me back then. But he gave me that look, you know that look? Some of you seen it from your parents. Some of you seen it from your lovers. Some of you seen it from your friends and bosses. That look that's kind of a mixture of pity and contempt. And I went and got my bottle of wine and went to blot it out. And unbeknownst to me, him seeing me like that, shaken and pathetic and dirty, and I guess I didn't look like I was having a party. And him seeing me like that snapped him. I didn't know this, but evidently he went and got a sponsor, changed his sobriety date. Didn't just get a sponsor, got one of those fanatical guys that we used to judge very harshly. you know, the guys that carry a book around and always grateful for everything. Oh, he got one of those guys, right? And he starts, I guess, working the steps, I suppose. I don't really know, but I imagine he did. And later on that year, I'm in another place, and he's the guy, one of the guys bringing the meetings in there. And I watched him come in with a couple guys he sponsored, and he was laughing a lot. And you know that thing I always saw in people's eyes, he had that he was lit up inside. And he was had a job. He drove there in his own car, and it was insured and registered. Oh my God, that's huge. That's huge. Oh man. And he had a job, and he'd gotten a raise, and he had a fiance, and they were going to get married, and they were even talking about buying a house. But more than the material stuff, I could see that he was happy about being sober, something that I couldn't imagine. And he was my first evidence that AA, the first time I ever saw it worked in others. And you got to understand, I'd been around by this time probably 100 AA meetings. But you're them, right? You're them. You're those people. This guy. I can't sell myself the bill of goods that, well, I'm different. I knew he was like me. We were cut from the same cloth. And that was my first, I guess, awakening. And that stuck with me, I'll tell you. I didn't get sober at that point, but it stuck with me. And then it says, and this is what I came to believe before I ever believed AA would work. It says, we'd come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we'd been living it. When those, I believed in that. And if you're a chronic relapser and you've gotten to those points time and time again where you know what you're doing to yourself. And you swear to yourself you're never going to touch that crap again. And 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 months later, you're back at it. I'm telling you, there's a futileness about that and a hopelessness after a while. I started hating myself for being that way. And I guess I came to believe in the hopelessness and futility of my life before I ever believed in AA or God or anything, really. And then it says, if those two things are present, if you've got that it worked in someone that's kind of like you, which means that maybe, just maybe, it could work for you. Just maybe. And you've come to the point of hopelessness and your life is futile. All the futility of someone who's trying to chase a party they can't catch. You can't get back to the good old days. Then it says, when therefore we were approached by those in whom the problems had been solved, there was nothing left but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. Nothing left. Some of the newer people here will drink again because you got something left. You got hope. You think hope's a good thing. When you approach recovery, hope's not a good thing. The reason is the hope is centered in yourself. You have hope that you can beat this time. You have hope that, well, this time I've learned my lesson. You have hope that, you know, if I get her back, you have hope that, man, if I get this job, you have hope that you're going to be all right. And we live in a society that ingrains that. One of my greatest liabilities is I try to think positive. Now, in the real world, that's an asset. You put me down. I'm on the streets. I got nothing. Well, I try to think positive. I think, well, I'm gonna get back up on my feet. I'm going to beat this thing. I'm just going to make up my mind. But that's all self-will. And that's part of the problem. In 1978... I had lost all hope of beating this. I lost all hope of jump-starting the party and getting, you know, if I could have got high again like I did when I was 18 and 20 years old, I'd have never got sober. And I lost all hope of fixing me. when I'm not drinking until the kind of person that's okay. I get these depressions, and I get this loneliness, and I don't fit anywhere. My mind just grinds away at me sober. And I'd been to therapy. I'd tried all the medications. And the problem is I'm still me, and I can't change me. And not from a lack of trying. I went to some seminars that were just amazing. I went to one time. They wouldn't let you sleep a whole weekend. They wouldn't let you sleep. Tell you, after about 48 hours without sleep, you're dealing with some feelings. I mean, they're just coming out of you, man. And I'll tell you, it changed my life for 2 weeks. Right? So there was nothing left but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at my feet, and that's exactly where I was. When I run into new guys in meetings, that they just took step one and they're happy about it, I go, wow. I wanted to slit my throat when I really got the truth about my predicament, my powerlessness. So how do you get to a point where there's nothing left? What has to happen to a guy? When I first got sober in 1978, something had changed within me, and I didn't know it right away. Because I don't have the presence of mind to get stuff easily like that. But it was probably pretty obvious to other people. I know that this one gal, Judy, who was a member of my home group and worked in the detox where I got detoxed in 78, she had known my history. And she said to me one day, she says, "What happened? You're going to 15 meetings a week? You got a spot?" She said, "You never did that stuff before, did you?" And I said, "No, I guess I never did." "And you're staying sober. You even look like maybe you're okay with it." I said, "It's all right. Not bad. I still was a little crazy and had bouts of depression from time to time. For the most part, it was I had some hope." And she said, "Well, what happened to you?" And I don't know. And there's a part on page 152 that kind of describes what had happened to me. Actually, it starts from the bottom of 151. And this is me in the years I relapsed. It says, "Now and then a serious drinker being dry at the moment says, 'Oh, I don't miss it at all. I feel better, work better, having a better time.' That's that part of me that's trying to be positive. And inside me, I'm dying. Inside me, I can't imagine life going on like it is. It says, as ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such as Sally. We know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself, inwardly, secretly. I would give anything to take a half dozen drinks and get away with them. I'd give any, my God, to be able to drink like I was 18 years old again. I'd give anything for that." And it says he will presently try the old game again. Why? Well, it answers the question. For he isn't happy about his sobriety. Not really. All this work better, feel better, all this, "Oh, how you doing, Bob? Oh, I'm just so glad to be sober." Not really. "Abstinence feels like I'm doing time. I'm not happy about my sobriety. Presently try this old game again." And it says he cannot picture life without alcohol. I couldn't picture life without alcohol. Not really. Or at least, well, that's not 100% true. I suppose I could imagine life without alcohol if I had enough drugs. Right? But I can't picture life without nothing. That's been my big secret all my life. I ain't no good. This ain't, life don't work for me like it works for you. So I can't picture life without alcohol. And then here's exactly what happened to me. It says, someday he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness such as few do. He'll be at the jumping off place and will wish for the end. On my last run, I tried to take my own life. I wished for the end. I got to the place where I was so stuck. There, I was in a trap that seemed like there was no way out. I failed, and I tried with everything in me. It's my life had become about trying to jumpstart a party I can't jumpstart, or about fixing me until so I could be the kind of guy that's comfortable enough sober that I don't have to go back to that madness. And I failed at both propositions. And drinking now is horrible, and not drinking is horrible. And so I'm trying to go sideways. I'm trying to take my own life because I can't imagine going on like this because I'm stuck. And I came off of that run, and it was ended up I was 2,000 miles away in Las Vegas in a hospital. And that's where I met my first sponsor, and I got my foot in the door in AA and started to do the things that everybody else did here. Now, I'm sober just a little while, and people in AA took good care of me. They gave me their time. They took me out to coffee. They bought me lunch at lunch meetings. They gave me clothes to wear. I had nothing. I was off the streets. Guys, amazing. There's some amazing lovers in AA that know how to love the unlovable. Guys, this guy one day, he came up to me at this noon meeting, and he says, "Man, I need your help." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah." He says, "Come on out to my car." And I got to his car, and he's got sport, nice stuff, sport coats and slacks and shirts in there, just all been dry cleaned, really nice stuff, and it's all about my size. And he says to me, he says, "Listen, my wife is on my case to clear some of this stuff out. If I don't get rid of this stuff, I'm going to be in a divorce here. You could really help me out to take this off my hands." I thought, well, you put it that way. See, if he'd have come up to me and said, "Oh, yeah, well, I know you don't have anything. Let me help you out." You know, I got that kind of I got that kind of deal going on, right? I could be dying, but I'm proud about it. You know what I mean? Right? You know, I'm just the way I am. And he also gave me some books and paperbacks and hardback books that he had read and didn't read, you know, had read them, and he knew, he'd heard me say that I like to read. So I'm reading this one book one day, and I'm not sober very long, and I read something in that book that allowed me to connect the dots, allowed me to know exactly what happened to me and why the course of my life was changing. And it's really what we just read in out of page 152. And the thing I read in this book was a little section of the book where they were talking about these scientists that were doing experiments on the human brain. And they discovered that in the human brain there was a part of the brain that had a Latin name for it, but they called it the pleasure center. It's the part of the brain that allows you to experience the euphoria from alcohol and drugs. It's where you get high. So what these scientists did is they got these laboratory rats and they put these two tiny wire filaments into the rat's pleasure center, and then they would pass a mild, undetectable, barely detectable electric charge through those wires just to stimulate that pleasure center. And they discovered when they stimulated it, the rat got high. So what they did is they hooked up the juice to the wires to a pedal in the rat's cage. And the rat would learn he could hit that pedal and get high, so the rat would just lay on the damn pedal. I mean, he don't drink water, he don't eat, he don't have sex, he don't do nothing. He's just partying, man, partying, partying, partying. And he would hit that pedal if they didn't interfere, he would hit that pedal till he died. Usually of dehydration, because he wasn't even drinking water. And what these scientists would do is they'd wait till a rat was just about dead. He'd gone that far, and they'd turn the juice off. And this time the rat goes back and he hits the pedal, but this time nothing happens. And he hits it again and nothing happens, and again and again and again and again, kind of like the last couple years of my drinking. And again and again. And after countless futile attempts to turn the juice back on, the rat gets it. He gets that the party is over once and for all. And instead of being able to go back to just being a rat, he curls up in a ball and lays on the floor of the cage to die. Because without the juice, there ain't nothing to live for. And I'm reading that, and I'm leaking water out of my eyes because I know that's exactly, that's me. I, if God would have come to me in early sobriety and gave me one wish, it wouldn't have been sobriety. It wouldn't have been a spiritual way of life. It wouldn't be a life where I'm going to help people, I'm telling you. That wouldn't have even been on my radar. What I would have said if he would have given me one wish and if I could have thought about it, here's what I probably would have said to God. I said, God, give me 5 years of partying like I partied when I was 18 years old. You give me those five good years like that, you can kill me at the end of those years, but give me those 5 years of playing with the bands and rocking and rolling and laughing with the guys. Give me 5 years of being lit up like I was lit up when I first started getting high. And instead, I don't get that. Instead, I get a big book and a sponsor and a home group. And 29 and a half, a little over 29 and a half years later, I stand here and I know something for sure. I know that Alcoholics Anonymous is not really designed to get you to quit drinking. If it was, there'd be a line in the book somewhere that says, Bob, quit. Cut it out. Stop that. It's not designed to get you to quit drinking. You want to quit drinking, punch a cop. You're going to quit for a little while. Alcoholics Anonymous is designed to turn the juice back on. It's designed to create a transformation inside of me that is very, very similar to getting high in the old days when getting high was its best. It's designed to free me of the only thing I ever needed to be free from is myself. See, that's always been the problem. I stop drinking. I just get me and my emotions and my very life just kind of on me until I can't take it anymore, and then I go get high. Alcoholics Anonymous is designed to do that. As a matter of fact, the single greatest promise, and I think in all of AA literature, is read in every meeting, and most people ignore it. And it's in step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the, meaning single only, as the result of these steps. Remember when you were a kid, the first started getting high? And five or six drinks would just wake something inside you that could come out and play and have fun. It lit you up. Alcoholics Anonymous, if it's worth anything at all, it must do that. And if it doesn't do that, and abstinence is just about not drinking, I'm dead meat because I can't hang. And it's not because I don't understand the necessity to quit drinking. I get that it's killing me. My spirit can't stay in that kind of a depressed, isolated, lonely, angst position indefinitely. I eventually will do anything to change the way I feel. Polly?
Polypistol alcoholic. Hi, good morning, good morning, good morning. It's good to see everybody. Look at this day. Gosh, what a glorious day. And we get to be in the book. That's even better. And we get to be sober and we get to be with each other. I mean, it's just, Sylvia and I got up this morning just saying, God, it's just gorgeous. It's just gorgeous. Came to believe in a power greater than myself that can return me to sanity. When I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was desperate. And I loved listening to Bob talk about that desperation. And I know that there's people in here that are fairly new and that you're here to hear this step study. And if there's anything I wish for you to this morning, is I wish you're desperate. I hope there's nothing left. I don't know about living in an abandoned room. I don't know about our abandoned building and not bathing and all of that, because that's not my story. But I know what it's like to die, to just absolutely die. And I'm one of these people. I didn't do a lot of partying. That's not what I did. I was, at the age of 18, I married an Air Force officer. And I was to go into the military, and there were certain things that were expected of me. And I was supposed to live a certain way, and I was supposed to behave as a lady and wear the right length gloves and the hats and all the stuff that you did back in the late 50s and the early 60s. And that was the what I was prepared to do at age 18. And at age 18, I was a person that was already full of inadequacy, of low self-worth, low self-esteem, all of those things. And what happened for me is what we learned in the doctor's opinion. I took a drink of alcohol and I could breathe because all of these expectations that I felt were put on me, and they were pretty much put on me. There was pretty much a reality to that. I mean, I went to a coffee one morning at the ripe old age of 18, and all us little second lieutenant's wives were sitting at this coffee while the base commander's wife commenced to tell us what we had to do to enhance our husband's career. And I had those feelings of overwhelming inadequacy that I had already had. But what happened is I'm listening to Bob, and I'm sitting there listening to him talk about laying in a building and not being, you know, not bathing and not being able to eat and all of those things. That felt just like I felt. It felt the same. Because what I'm doing now in the end of my drinking is I am the mother of two teenage boys. And I am laying on a sofa and I cannot get up. I am so drunk and I'm so debilitated from the disease of alcoholism that I no longer can take care of my children. I'm going to tell a little story. I have a son who's sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he talks, and I get to hear his story, and it never ceases to cause me a lot of pain. And it's not that I haven't, that's not that I don't know that God has forgiven me, because I do know that. Because I could not be, I live a life beyond anything I ever expected I could live. So I know I'm forgiven. But you know, the book talks about we don't want to regret the past, but we don't want to shut the door on it. You know, I need the past in order so I can share my experience, strength, and hope with you. So I need that past. But the past is, it's my son talks about living as the child of an alcoholic. And he has an alcoholic mom who is the only parent that's really present in his life. And what he does, this is his reality to life. He gets up in the morning to go to school. His mother is passed out on the kitchen floor. A drink is spilled. And what he does is he steps over her, gets his cereal, you know, puts it all together, puts the box back, puts the milk back in the refrigerator, steps back over me, sits down, and eats his breakfast. That's not a normal reaction to life. But that's how dead we become inside, whether we live with the disease or we have the disease. And so when that little something, I'd gone into treatment twice, and I had gone into a detox center that was a 7-day detox, and what happened for me is, you know, as soon as I, you know, get the shakes are kind of gone, and I've got that kind of ego that just recovers, which happens for the alcoholic. We have this ego that just recovers so fast. And I walk in there, and I'm all ashamed, and my husband has picked me up. I've just had a car wreck, and he asked me to go into this treatment center, and I go in, and I've got the whole alcoholic thing going. You know, we're on the way to surrender. The whole alcoholic thing going, you know. I'm so sorry. Oh, look what I've done, da-da-da-da. And then I get to feeling a little bit better, and this This is a county detox, so it's a social model detox. So, you know, I get to feeling a little better and everything's okay. And I'm in this treatment center, and this is not a fancy jitter joint. This is a county detox, and it's me and 11 guys. And I was kind of cute back then, you know, and I've been drunk for so long, and I start getting sober, and my libido starts kind of kicking in, and I got these 11 guys, and I start thinking that I'm enjoying this attention. I'm really enjoying this attention. And the next thing I know, that seven-day detox is up, and one of the guys and I, you know, we've had one of these jitter house romances, you know, where sick falls in love with sick, and you're off and going. And I end up in a motel room, and I've been beaten up and lots of things. And I'm 12-stepped and brought back into that treatment center. Now I'm more desperate. I am more desperate. But now I got more stuff I didn't have before. I mean, I had enough with what I'd done to my kids and my husband and my parents. Now I've got a whole new bucket of shame that I'm going to bring into that treatment center. And Clancy has a tape out, and I love this tape, and it's called Alcoholism, a Disease of Perception. But on that tape, he talks about the perception and how we think. Bill, I love what Bill calls it. Perception, I think, is a little more modern word, and that's what Clancy uses. Bill calls it twisted. We have twisted thinking. And my thinking is twisted. But on this tape, he talks about the disease of alcoholism and how that alcohol doesn't have anything to do with the disease. If alcohol were our problem, well, we wouldn't all need to be sitting here. We just need to quit drinking. That'd be all. We just quit drinking and, you know, we'd be fine. But what I do is I have a disease, and that disease is always wants me to drink again. Always it's there, sitting waiting for me to drink again. And somehow I've got to come to believe in a power that's going to be there for me so that I stop the insanity of drinking again. And let me tell you, I had the kind of arrogance that I really thought that to be insane was more acceptable than to be an alcoholic. Now, that's talk about twisted thinking. I mean, look at us. If somebody walked down the hall today and they saw this group of people sitting in here, I mean, we look like a pretty good group of people. You know, we're happy. They're not going to have a clue that that's a bunch of dying losers sitting there. They're not going to have a clue. We look good. But I tell you what, if you're sitting in an insane asylum on some Thorazine chewing on your tongue, they're going to know what's wrong with you. So, I mean, there was the insanity right there. To think to be insane was better than to be an alcoholic. And that's how I felt, because I saw no hope. And I love the way he talked, that we can't have hope. We can't come into these rooms, and for me, I don't want to speak for anybody else, but for me, I can't come into these rooms and have one shred of hope or one more good idea. I can't have it. And now I come back into that treatment center, and Clancy talks about sobriety and how it feels to be sober without a program. And I get it. And I don't understand about the steps. And I don't understand that it's going to change my life. I just know I can't live sober. I know I cannot live sober inside my own skin. There's no way. And I do, excuse me, I do just what Bob does. I'm gonna off myself. I can't live sober inside my own skin. And what I do is I know how to do a little time. You know, sitting in this detox center, I can do a little time. And when the 7 days is up, I go get a bottle of scotch and I go get a bottle of Valium and I thank you, darling. And I check into a motel because I can't live sober. I can't do it. because I have no hope that I can't live sober and I can't live drunk. And the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous calls that the dilemma of the alcoholic. I can't do either one. And I don't know about this power because I come out of this very rigid Southern Baptist bringing up that I have laid aside many years ago. I've laid that religion aside because what happened for me is that God, I feel like, wants to kill me. And when they say, you know, when it talks about a power, came to believe in a power, I know what, you're not fooling me. That's just, that's just playing with words. I know what you're talking about. I'm smart. You know, I know that you're just saying that, But see, I didn't understand because somebody hadn't taken me through this book yet. And I didn't understand that there's lots of powers out there. There's powers out there. You know, it's like Bob said, if you want to get sober, hit a cop. That's a power greater than yourself. You know, that'll get your attention. You know, that'll happen. I didn't understand all that stuff. But what I needed to do was I needed to find a power. And what happened was, is I did, on April the 8th of 1977, and my sobriety date is April the 11th, I was pronounced dead on arrival in a hospital in Bedford, Texas. I had done it. And I had totally committed suicide. And the reason I choose April the 11th is when you, in 1977, it's not a lot different than it is in 2008. If you try to commit suicide, you get the attention of the authorities, you know. And in 1977, I got the attention of the authorities. My girlfriend, you know, it's amazing. We were talking last night about those seconds and inches. And all our little bricks and our own little brick, our little brick path and our on our way to happy destiny, we have, just like our history, is so rich. And if anything hadn't happened just the way it happened, none of us would be sitting here. And the same is with our lives. And what happened is, I had a girlfriend, and she said something came over her, and she felt like she needed to find me. And you know, today I know what that was. That was God working in my life through her. That was a power. That was a power greater than me. I didn't create that. I didn't do that. But she felt that. She didn't know anything about alcoholism. She just loved me. And she went looking for me, and she found my car parked outside a motel. And you know how when you'll shut a door and it doesn't latch, it's still just open? That's what I had done. And she pushed that door open, and she found me, and she called 911. And I was pronounced dead on arrival at that hospital. Well, I'm standing here. So I truly believe that I have divine intervention. We are graced. How do you live in a building in that kind of filth? How do we do that? Look back on our stories and see how are anybody, you know, talk about the cat with nine lives. Alcoholics, I think, have 25 or more. You know, look at what, how many times we have car wrecks and just on and on and on and on. There is a power out there. There is something out there that is doing something. And that's what I always thought, that it was way out there in the sky. Because if that was the way I thought they were talking about it. I thought when I was my Christian bringing up, that's what I thought. They were talking about this God that lived up in the sky and that was looking down on you, and he wanted you to burn in hell if you did anything wrong. So this God was, you know, I was doomed. I was hopeless. God didn't want me. I was hopeless. So I just wanted to die. And this power is there. Then I had another power. My husband, my ex-husband, I've been very loved. Both of my husbands, I have a fabulous husband today, and my first husband was a fabulous man as well. I'm the bad person here. I wish I could stand up and say I was beaten, people did bad things to me. I can't. And I love the way you, the way Bob said it last night at dinner. I wish I had somebody to hang it on. I came here with nobody to hang it on. But it, I think that's great, because the more I begin to take responsibility for myself, the quicker I'm going to get better. And I had this man who loved me. So what happened was, is they put me on one of those 72-hour holds. Do they have those in Salt Lake City? You know, where the police put you on a 72-hour hold and put you in a psychiatric hospital, and you have to stay there for 3 days? That's what happened to me. And in that 3 days, my husband obtained a court order from a Fort Worth judge that said I was a detriment to myself and others, and court committed me to treatment. That's a power greater than myself. That power threw me into treatment against my will. How dare them do that to me? And something happened while I was in there. And I did not know if I could believe in God. But I had to come to believe in a power, because this book keeps talking about it. You know, it's like the great fact is the great fact and nothing less that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences. These were spiritual experiences. All of these little things had happened. This was pointed out to me. Look how this power, Polly, is working in your life. Did you ask them to do this for you? This was power. And they kept pointing these things out. And it kept saying that I had to accept spiritual help, that I had to get help from something that was spiritual. And I couldn't do that. So what I was told is to put God, G-O-D, and that when I was going into an AA meeting, have that be a group of drunks. And that's, you know where that came from? Not a new idea. That's what they did in the Oxford group. That's how they helped drunks get sober in the Oxford group, because they had the drunk squad. And the drunk squad helped the alcoholics. Because, you know, with alcoholics, especially back then, you can't say the God word. You know, we can't say the God word. So it kept talking about that I had to find this power greater than myself that was going to restore me to sanity. So little by little, what happens is, and, you know, I'm always hearing this, I need this feeling of God. I need to feel God. And, you know, I'd love to feel God all the time. I'd really like to feel, you know, it would be so amazing if I just had this wonderful feeling of God and I was always relaxed. And I'm sorry, this altitude dries my throat out. It causes me, I bet you guys are used to that. But I wanted to have this feeling. You know, if you have God in your life and this power, you must feel something. You must, you know. But then I was told, if I've got God in my life, then it's going to take some action for me to do things. And so I began to do things. And what I would do is I would clean up the coffee cups. I would sweep the floor. I began to do things in Alcoholics Anonymous, and those things started to make me feel better about myself. Because I am a person, I'm not an agnostic. Back over in the agnostics, it talks about, but after a while we had to face the fact that we must find a spiritual basis of life or else. And that's on page 44. I had to find a spiritual life or else. And one of the things that I love about the chapter We Agnostics is it starts to make this power. I think Bill wrote this. This chapter is so, makes God so approachable, so that we can start to see how this power is going to work in our lives. And let me tell you something. I'm sober 31 years, and there is a lot of times that I'm stuck in step two, that I somehow think I've got the power to change something. When the reality is I know that I have to believe in a power greater than myself to return me to sanity, because I can go insane sober. I've got a son who yesterday was 48 years old, and I am in a constant state of surrender over him, because after 31 years, I watch my son not be able to find peace in his life. And I want to somehow be able to have the power to control that. And guess what happens to me when I try that? When I try one more time to move in there and try to help him. You know, I'm going to help him. And one more time I try to go in there, and one more time I find that insanity. I have to learn that lack of power. This is on page 45 in the second, starting up, it's really the first paragraph, was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. One of the things that I believe is, a lot of times, I have a sponsor, and Dottie is probably... I just always feel that she's just got such a connection with God. Now, the reality is she's always telling me, Polly, my connection isn't any better than your connection. But you know what? Somehow, I believe hers is better. And maybe that's a good thing, because she's been my sponsor for 26 years. And maybe that's a really good thing, that I believe that her connection is better. Because what happens is when I talk to her about something, and it's usually 9 times out of 10, it's about, you know, my son who lives in Southern California. It's about him, because his life doesn't work. And she brings me back to that I don't have the power, and that Russ has a higher power, and it's not me. And, you know, you'd think after 31 years I would get that. You know, that I would get that. But I can come right back to this step every time and know that I have to count on a power greater than me, and that what's going on in his life is none of my business. It's none of my business. But I'm an alcoholic with an alcoholic ego, and I can slip back into that. And the moment I start going back in that, trying to control somebody else's life with all my wisdom, and, you know, I'm in there with the good news. Let me tell you what you can do, and your life will work. Lack of power. That's our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. Well, that's exactly what this book is about. What this book is about is we had to find, the book is about, is a main object, I'm going back up to the other sentence, sorry. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. My problem is to get out of the way and let God do his job. And what I can do is I can show up to Park City, Utah, and I can do what I'm asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous and be the very best example that I can be, keep my nose in this book and my nose out of his life, and be an example to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and let God work in his life. Because he's got alcoholism, whether he's got it by ingestion or he's affected by it. He's got alcoholism. And believe me, you go try to tell an alcoholic to do something, and boy, they're going to do just the opposite. I ought to know that after all this time. I really ought to know that. That means we have written a book which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral. And it means, of course, that we are going to be talking about God. Here, difficulty arises with agnostics. I'm not sure I thought that I believed in God when I got here. I just didn't believe that God believed in me. And I don't know if that's agnostic. I really don't know how to split the hairs on all that. All I knew is that there was a God out there. I had heard about that since I was a child. I just believed that that God and what I had done was not going to help me. So what I had to do is I had to start to put my faith in the beginning and to people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I don't know if any of that will work for you, but I can tell you, I believe that two of us has more power than me. I believe that. And that if I sit down with you and I talk to you, that I'm going to be able to have some of your power. And that's what was true. All my first AA sponsor, Frank, used to say to me is that, Polly, just believe that I believe. And you can borrow my higher power for as long as you need to. Back on page 44, it says, and I think this is something that it talks about, follow a few simple rules that we learned earlier in the book. But after a while, we had to face the fact. You know, we may sit up there and say, I'm not going to believe in God. I'm not going to believe in this program. I'm not going to believe in these spiritual principles. But it says we had to face the fact that we must find a spiritual basis of life or else. And one of the things that I hear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's that it doesn't matter. You know, you can sit there and say, I'm not going to believe in God. I don't want to hear about God. And what will happen is if you run outside of these rooms, if you live to tell the tale, alcohol will run you back in. I'm just not afraid to talk about God. I will tell you how I found a way to God because I couldn't believe in God. And first I had to have a belief before I could have a trust. And, you know, when we talk about the difference in believing there's a God and then trusting in a God, one of my heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous, who died a few months ago by the name of Keith Lewis, used to have this analogy he used to talk about. He used to talk about the tightrope walker with a wheelbarrow. You know, it's going to push the wheelbarrow across the tightrope. And he says, you know, you can believe that that tightrope walker is going to get across that tightrope with that wheelbarrow. Trusting that he is when you get in the wheelbarrow and let him push you. That's the difference. But I first had to come to believe. Not trust. The step says believe. I had to first come to believe. And it says here, much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect a contact with him. So if I just believed that Frank believed, that was enough of a conception. If I just came into the rooms and saw that AA was working in your life, my son says to me, that the reason he got sober, he says he would have gotten sober quicker if I hadn't have been on him all the time. Because, you know, I felt like I knew he needed AA the same day I did. But if I had just left him alone. He said, but I came to believe I saw AA work in my mother's life. And if I knew that if an alcoholic as bad and as mean as she was could get sober, I came to believe that something was going on in Alcoholics Anonymous. I saw it. And I would hear people tell stories like Bob told. And see, somehow my arrogance believed that me dying on the sofa, you know, tearing up the lives of my two teenage children, that somehow or another I was a little higher bottom than him. Doesn't matter. What happened was both our souls were dead. Both souls are dead. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter where Skid Row is. It can be, you know, in your living room. Like he says, in a $5 million mansion, you can have Skid Row. and you can't live any longer and you blow your brains out. However inadequate, if all you can say is, well, my gosh, she's sober. Maybe she's telling the truth and her life really was that bad. That's enough. We go on. Do not let any prejudice. We talked about that at dinner. Don't let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. What does it mean to me? What does this power mean to me? Does this power mean if I walk into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I sit down among you, and I walk out and I have a day of sobriety? That's powerful, because I have this power. I don't even really have the compulsion to drink. Something's going on. There's something working. There's some kind of power working because I'm sober. And I can't deny that I'm sober. When I was standing over here just a few days before, and I can't not drink no matter what. I have to drink no matter what. And this power, whatever it is there. We need to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say that he does believe, or he's willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he is on his way. He has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this spirit simple cornerstone, a wonderful, effective spiritual structure can be built. Okay, maybe we're going to take a break.
Yeah, about 9 minutes.